You're listening to the OneOfUs.net Podcast Network.
One of Us is a podcast and video network funded all but entirely by donations and subscriptions. We do accept pitches for audio-based or banner ads, but on a case-by-case basis. If you're interested in that, contact us at oneofusnet@gmail.com. With the amount of audio and video content we generate, it is expensive and extremely time-consuming to keep things running. Please go to the webpage oneofus.net and sign up for a subscription at $2, $5, $10, or $25 and get a ton of bonus content. One of Us needs and appreciates all your support. I don't know about you guys, I'm ready to just burn some shit down. I'm already mad enough. A Facebook meme can make me take to the streets at this point. So you get, as far as I'm concerned, a great American poet like Aaron Sorkin trying to establish using a historical precedent for why the system is fucked. You're going to get me all fired up. And sure enough, originally supposed to be set for theaters, originally supposed to be directed by Steven Spielberg, but now written and directed by the legendary Aaron Sorkin, The Trial of the Chicago 7 ended up in this time of COVID getting going right to Netflix. But I think this is going to be the year that nobody is going to be going. I mean, they're certainly not going to go, well, you can't nominate that for an Academy Award because it didn't play in theaters. Nothing played in theaters.
Robert De Niro has a shot just based on the war with Grandpa.
Fool with Grandpa, right? But this is one I'd say is going to be a front runner for several of the big awards this year. Yep. At least that's how I felt about it. Let's introduce the rest of the crew. I've got Nathan.
Hey, resident Sorkin fan.
Yeah, it was funny. I was talking about it earlier, and Brad's like, oh, man, you got to do that review with Nathan. He's totally a Sorkin, like, apologist. I'm like, apologist? Fuck you. Sorkin's one of the greatest human beings who's ever lived. He's like, oh, you're one of those guys, too. Huh? I'm like, you're damn straight I am.
I have had many a cynical conversation with Bradley on Sorkin, and he's not always wrong.
That's why we call him Bradley, not always wrong Sorkin. I'm sorry. Bradley, not always wrong, Marco.
You can't say it. This is not an auspicious beginning to your review not. This evening, Marco. But that's Marco.
I'm just going to say, watch it. I mean, that's all you want to hear me say. It's like, I don't got 20 minutes to listen to these bastards talk on and on and on. Should I watch it or not? That's what they want to know.
Here's the upshot. Yes.
Spoiler warning, we liked it.
Mark, how are you doing?
Doing great. Yeah, I enjoyed it too. Let's get into it.
Okay, let us get into it. Now,
and the review is over.
Yeah, that was that simple, guys. Woo! No, this follows the story of the Chicago 7, which are a group of anti-Vietnam War protesters that showed up at the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago and were arrested sort of in a more symbolic sense of who they were than in anything they actually did, because the police claimed that this group of people got together and conspired to turn these protests into a straight-up riot against the police, amongst other charges that happened. And a lot of these people were countercultural heroes already. For instance, Abbie Hoffman, this legendary hippie, sort of leader of the hippies, if you will, played here in a, I would say, flat-out Oscar-nominatable performance by Sacha Baron Cohen, and I never thought I'd say those words, considerably more played down, both in terms of the effects of the after effects of his name and as well the performance of said characters, Eddie Redmayne as Tom Hayden. You've got legendary founder of the Black Panthers, Bobby Seale, played by Yahya Abdul-Mateen II. David Dellinger, who was the head, I'm trying to remember, he was like one of the leaders of the Democratic Party at that point. John Carroll Lynch, for once not playing a creepy serial killer, which is nice.
Yeah.
Jerry Rubin, another huge hippie countercultural guy that ended up stopping being a hippie and created the Yippie movement, which was sort of a cross between yuppies and hippies. Don't ask. Played by Jeremy Strong. Really, this is one of these films, like, every face you see is going to be familiar to you.
Yeah, I mean, the whole review is just us going through the cast.
Yeah, exactly. Read out the cast like you read out the names of people who died that month in Vietnam.
Considerably less people.
There's a bunch of, oh, that guy moments. Like, oh, it's that guy.
But the other big names worth knowing is Mark Rylance plays William Kunstler, one of the most famous lawyers of the 20th century, and certainly on the liberal side, so regularly fighting for liberal causes, and often quite successfully. Frank Langella as Judge Julius Hoffman, who apparently had one of the lowest ratings of competence by his fellow judges at any point during that decade. He's widely been regarded as history as a terrible example of someone who let that sort of power go right to their head.
75% of the bar voted against his competence or something like that?
It was like higher than that. It was like 82.
78.
Jojo Levitt as Richard Schultz.
He was the head prosecutor.
So it's all these guys, the seven, which were actually the eight, because Bobby Seale was sort of an add-on, even though, as he famously was like, look, man, I've never even met these guys before you arrested us, and I was in Chicago for like 4 hours, which he kept saying in the movie. The truth is, he was there for like 2 days. But still, there was absolutely no reason to think that he was involved in any way with these other guys. And sure enough, he wasn't, and eventually, at one point, they split him off. His story is one of the most frustrating in this whole thing, to be sure.
Oh, definitely.
Because he's like, well, my lawyer can't be here, like, literally is sick in the hospital. The judge is like, no, you can't delay the trial, which there's absolutely no reason not to under the circumstances. And he kept going, hey, I don't have a lawyer. And the judge is like, shut up. I only want to hear from your lawyer. He's like, I don't have a lawyer.
Yeah, it's like, you got a lawyer right there sitting next to you.
And he has a right to represent himself, too. I mean, he keeps denying him that right. He's like, he totally has a right to represent himself.
The whole case was built by the federal government on the idea that these seven or eight people were in Chicago, in the area, during the riot, part of the countercultural movement, all of them belonging to different organizations, sometimes that did not always agree politically, but by virtue of the fact that they were all there and that they had all crossed state lines, that could be construed as crossing state lines with the conspiracy to incite a riot. That was the game plan. That's how they were going to get them. So in order for that to happen, they all had to be lumped together as one group to make the conspiracy charge stick. And as we find out, previous administration didn't think that was a good enough charge because they felt that the Chicago police had, more than anyone, had incited the riot. But once we have the change from the Johnson administration to the Nixon administration, Nixon, running on a law and order platform, decided that his attorney general, David Mitchell, was going to seek an indictment on all of these guys. That's where the Joseph Gordon-Levitt character comes in. He's the new young prosecutor that they have assigned to this case. And there is a delicious irony in a character of David Mitchell giving him his marching orders, because even the Levitt character is like, this is a weak case. And he's like, no, you're going to win. Because that's what we're going to do. We're going to indict these sons of bitches on conspiracy. And the irony, of course, is that within less than a decade, David Mitchell himself would be charged with conspiracy for Watergate and go to prison. So that was a nice little factoid to have in the back of your mind while that scene's playing out.
Now, you might be saying to yourself, God, I mean, I didn't know anything about any of this, but it all sounds so damn familiar. Why does this sound so familiar? Because it's literally happening right now in our country, which is why, of course, they're making this movie.
But only dumber.
It's actually been on the books to make this film for 10 years.
Yeah.
Right? Like, yeah. Spielberg first brought it to Sorkin, like, way, like, over a decade ago. But this year is why this got rushed into production. And it's not surprising. It is timely. It will make you even more upset because of the relevance in all the issues that are there. And the fact that we're dealing with just seeing the beginning of this stuff, because as we know, Trump packed the courts with incompetent and inappropriate judges. And we haven't even seen the results of some of what's going to fall out from that. But we're going to be seeing cases like this happening a lot, I suspect, in the next 5-10 years because of that situation. This movie will make you angry, but it'll also make you laugh, like, a lot. Because Abbie Hoffman, Sacha Baron Cohen, and
Jerry Rubin.
Thank you. Their swarm of counterculture was like Merry Prankster style, where it was like, yes, it was about like doing huge stunts and pranks and jokes. Right. And this movie, you'll go, well, they obviously exaggerated a lot of stuff for dramatic effect. And then I read about it and they're like, no, they had to cut out a lot because they thought no one will ever believe this actually happened.
Especially from the judge, played by Frank Langella, who is like one of the most infuriating characters I've seen in a while. This movie is one of the most entertaining, infuriating movies I've ever seen. As a directing testament to Aaron Sorkin, which I liked Molly's Game, I like this a hell of a lot more. I think it shows that he can direct the hell out of it. I actually wouldn't have Steven Spielberg direct this. They would have probably been comparable, but there's a way how he directs his own dialogue to where he really lets the editing flow with his dialogue in a way I haven't seen out of any director outside of maybe Fincher. It's just impressive on every level, especially the cast. Mark Rylance really stood out to me.
And this story has been adapted for stage, radio, and film many times over the years, oftentimes using the actual court transcripts or the participation of the original people.
Film.
Yeah, there's, I mean, this is not, this is a well-toned story.
I thought you were going to say there's even an anime. Like, okay.
I wouldn't be surprised. There's a PlayStation game of it. They're like, press the counselor button, press the counselor button. Object, object.
That tentacle monster was an obvious radical.
That's like the Kumbayashi Maru of PlayStation games.
You just can't win.
Sorry, Marco. We're just talking over your ass.
It's okay. I'm just talking about the movie we were reviewing. I'm surprised. I'm usually the one drifting off in a pointless digression. So no, but this has been done many times before. But by virtue of the cast, by virtue of the director, the pedigree of this, by the virtue of the fact that it's on Netflix and widely accessible, there's no reason not to. I'm not going to tell you this is the story or the most accurate version. I'm sure there's plenty of dramatic license. You're taking a trial that lasted over half a year and condensing it into a little over 2 hours. But what is here is masterful, even though I felt that sometimes with 7 to 8 defendants and several more supporting characters, you don't get to do a lot of character work. But really, for me, the heart of the film, when they do settle on character, it's the ongoing debates that are happening between Abbie Hoffman and Tom Hayden, who represent two very different poles of the left wing, one being very irreverent, merry prankster, very, you know, burn the system down, whereas Eddie Redmayne is more of look, we have to get elected, because if we don't get elected, if we don't become part of the system, we can't change it. And that, I thought, was a fascinating argument that I wish they would have explored more. It's there, with Mark Rylance, of course, in the middle, being exasperated not only with the judge, but his own clients, who can't seem to agree with one another.
It is based on a real story, and it is based on real people, but this film isn't about them being real people. It's about every single one of them standing for a certain segment of the populace or a type of person, which isn't exactly the same now as it is then, but it's easily interpretable what you're talking about, really. And I think it works largely because of the fact that it's so damn funny and fast-moving and well-acted. If you're, like, curious, well, what about the judge? Does he love his family? Where did he go to school? It's not relevant, because this isn't a movie about the characters on that level. Yeah. It's about the issues and what these characters stand for.
I was just talking about the Chicago 7, because really, it's about two or three guys. There's two characters that the script even acknowledges. Why are we even here? They're like, you're here so that we could acquit you later and the court will look like they're merciful. And that's all those guys are there in the movie for. And even Bobby Seale, who's great in it, he does eventually leave the story, thankfully for the real Bobby Seale. But once he's gone, a lot of the righteous anger and dynamism of the film kind of dissipates a little bit for the lack of his presence.
It's not just the facets of the left wing. They show a large part of the right wing in terms of the Schultz character is a more moderate right winger who actually tries to see the other side of the story, as opposed to that bad guy, right winger, conservative, which is unreasoning hatred and fear, which is both from the Attorney General and also from the Judge Hoffman character.
Yeah, who also are representing portions of the Republican Party even today.
Right.
They, like I said, they're more a symbol for that portion of the party. And it's indicting them for even being collaborative in the process.
Absolutely. Yeah, without allowing it to fall into caricature.
As much as this movie is very timely, we're seeing a lot of shades of what has gone on in here. I should just urge viewers, if you are not a fan of the Sorkin idealism, the almost Capra-esque quality that he has, it's all there. This is firmly in the Sorkin universe. A lot of the Republican characters are made to be a little bit more sympathetic. I know Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character was described as a pit bull and an angry dog, IRL. You don't get any of that. It's just that aw shucks, no. Joseph Gordon-Levitt look.
No, he's very moderate in this.
Therein lies a bit of my problem with the movie, especially with the ending. For a movie that is so entertaining yet so infuriating, it goes for this, I would almost call it as schmaltzy as Sorkin has ever gotten, with this closing statement by Eddie Redmayne, he might as well have said, "Oh, Captain, my Captain," and then stepped on top of his desk, because it's literally one of those moments, triumphant music, like, "Everybody sit down!" You know, that sort of shit. I felt like it really undercut it, because this movie should leave you infuriated as you're coming out, and it tries to give you this sort of happy-ish ending where you think, like, the good guys really got one over. And in reality, no, not really. And I think that we're mature enough to take the actual ending, you know?
I don't know. I felt like this being as filled with symbolism as it is in terms of who the characters are representing, and that it being as broad as it is, and as being, as you said, as very, like, in the Sorkin verse, it needed a big emotional moment ending. And to be fair, that's not exactly what happened, but that did happen in the trial. That's not made up. That really happened. It wasn't at the end of the trial, but that was a thing that happened.
Yeah.
So much of what actually did happen that was huge and crazy doesn't even happen in this movie. So it's almost like, well, we'll just sub out that and sub in this because it works better for the timing of the way things work out. I had no problem with that. There was that moment, I'm like, are we really doing that? Okay, everybody stand up who disapproves moment. We are, aren't we? But it worked. I want most of the people who see this movie and fall in love with it to be, you know, Joe Normal America, who's like, yeah, wow, this movie made me think about a lot of stuff, and I got emotional at the end, and not directed at me, already sold and got my membership card, cynical critic. It's certainly not as great as I think it ultimately could have been, but it's still pretty damn great.
Oh, yeah.
But let's go to final thoughts. Nathan, with your counterpoint, what is your final thoughts?
This was a great sophomore debut. Well, sophomore debut. Aaron Sorkin's been around for so fucking long.
Yeah.
I mean, sophomore directing.
He's an up-and-coming guy. I look forward to his new
work.
Yeah,
I wonder if that Sorkin will stick around.
Keep
an eye
on that guy.
He's a young
spark. This is a really good
is.
Sophomore directorial effort by Aaron Sorkin. The cast, like I said, you could throw an Academy Award nomination at anybody in the cast, and I'll take it. Like, we haven't really talked about how great Yahya Abdul-Mateen is. He's not in the movie a lot. Yeah. But holy fuck, is he a scene stealer. And everybody perfectly plays their character. The dialogue is just as witty as you would expect. But it's not as, you know, like, Sorkin gets criticized very often, and with some merit, that a lot of his characters are just fast talking to the level where they're saying exactly what you would hope to say one day as a politician or member of the radical left. But yeah, regardless, I would say 8 out of 10 awful accents by Eddie Redmayne, because, oh my God, did he ever really upset me with the way how he talked?
He wasn't whispering.
Every time I hear someone criticize Sorkin for that, people don't actually talk that way. I'm like, I'm going to assume you've never been to the theater,
yeah,
like, at all.
People don't talk like Shakespeare. They don't talk like Oscar Wilde. They talk the way we'd like people to talk.
If you want people to talk like actual people, watch a John Cassavetes film and then realize, oh, fuck, yeah, I don't want this.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. Mark, what are your final thoughts?
There's a lot of things I liked about it. There were a few things I didn't like about it. I love Sorkin. I do. I worship the West Wing and everything else. And what was it, The Newsroom? Love that, too.
And Sports Night.
And Sports
oh,
Night.
Oh, fuck yeah,
right.
Sports Night. And Studio 60. Yeah. I like Studio 60. I love my liberal
not so
porn.
Much Studio 60.
It is liberal porn.
But Sorkin's got his little tropes and everything. And plus, you add that if you're a Generation X like me, you grew up hearing about the 60s and having it shoved up your yin-yang. To the point where you look at the current iteration of boomers and you feel that they betrayed a lot of their values. What's good about this film is that it brings it back. It says there was a time when they really were working for something amazing, and it filled you with hope. And it fills you with hope that people can do that again in this generation. And that's ultimately what purpose this film serves to me. It's a parallel. Everything seems to be a parallel to Trump these days. But this film especially worked because it's eerie how many similarities there are to the techniques used, skullduggery that's used, that is done for the good of the country, good of the culture. The Abbie Hoffman character talks about it being a political trial. I would argue it's a cultural trial. Again, I love it. I love the performances, especially of Cohen. And I like a lot of the bit things. Michael Keaton has a role as the previous attorney general, and the whole scene just melts around him. He just takes up the spotlight perfectly. He's amazing. Ultimately, this is going to be a film I think is going to be really relevant in the future. I think it's the kind of film that's going to be shown in schools. And honestly, it really only needs a minor amount of editing to do that. I would give it 8 out of 10 undercover seductresses.
I want to see the spin-off sequel just about her,
yeah,
quite frankly.
Yeah, she was interesting.
Yeah. Marco?
This will be shown in schools, and then angry parents will write letters to the superintendent going, why is this liberal propaganda trash being shown to my children? I'm ready for that to happen. Because this is a little bit propagandistic, but Aaron Sorkin has always been a reliable supplier of left-leaning centrist porn. It's what we love, we get off on it, and it helps us kind of get through a pretty fucking miserable existence we have right now. So I can't fault him for that. Is this going to change the needle? I don't know. There are people out there who can't seem to understand that the X-Men is an allegory for accepting people who are different from you, and yet they claim to be X-Men fans.
Do you know the QAnon people right now? They just latched onto this. They think JFK Jr. is going to be brought out alive and well and a Trump supporter at rally.
I've heard
they're walking around wearing t-shirts for it. This is where that portion of America is who you could never reach. I think there are still those undecideds out there, and this is the kind of film that you hope that would make them start to pay attention.
If you're undecided at this point, look, I don't know how you get out of bed in the morning. I mean, are you undecided? Should I tie my shoes or not? Or maybe I should just walk down the street and take the chance that I won't trip over myself. I don't know. My house is on fire. Maybe now is the time I should install smoke detectors. Or should I call the fire department first? I don't have any patience for this mythical undecided voter. You're just an idiot. Or low information voter. At this point, if you haven't been bothered to actually look up and like, well, gee, there's so many issues. What, have you tried reading a newspaper, sir?
I just feel like I don't know enough about both of the candidates, Marco. I'm sorry.
Could you have a beer with one of them? That's what I want to know. Could you have a beer with one of them?
Oh, my gosh.
I know that's last election, but...
On one hand, this candidate, there's a picture of him smelling his granddaughter's hair. And also, 50 years ago, he said something a little racist. Yeah, he's apologized 300 times for it, but I'm not sure he means it. And on the other hand, is this guy... Oh, wait, the choice is obvious.
As someone who enjoys drinking beer... I like drinking beer. I like hanging out with my buddies and drinking beer. I don't want to fucking drink a beer with the president. If I were drinking a beer with the president, I'd be like, why the fuck are you here having a beer with me? Get the fuck to work.
And then he leans in close to you and in your mom's voice says, wake up, Marco. Wake up.
Well, that's usually followed immediately after I have the dream where I forgot my line. But I was reviewing this movie and about to go into my final thoughts.
Sorry.
That's okay. This has actually been fun. That's probably the most entertaining part of the thing. All the shit we talk about in between. I didn't like this. I do think it does have its flaws in that some of the central characters are not very well defined. As I said, you have a cast of seven, but as it's very quickly established, not all of them carry the same weight or have the same importance and are not focused upon. Really, this comes down to Sacha Baron Cohen as Abby Hoffman, Eddie Redmayne as Tom Hayden, with, you know, a little first half support from Yahya Abdul-Mateen as Bobby Seale. That, for me, is the heart of the movie. That and the way the character of Mark Rylance tries to balance his clients while also trying to deal with a judge who has just completely gone off the rails into unconstitutional territory. Is it going to change the dialogue in the country? Is it going to make anybody change their mind, how they vote or how they look at protesters or Black Lives Matter supporter? Nah, art doesn't do that. I wish it did. Doesn't do it fast enough anyway. No one who is going to be sitting on the fence going, you know what, after I saw an Aaron Sorkin movie, I think I'm going to vote Democratic for the first time. Not going to happen. Wish it would. I'm sure Aaron Sorkin is sitting somewhere in his bunker with cocaine on his nose going, God damn it, I wish they would just vote for them already. It's not going to happen. But this is the point of art. It's the point of art is to get people to talk, not to change their minds. If it changes their minds, great. I can only ultimately review it as a piece of entertainment. And I was entertained. At a little over 2 hours and 10 minutes, this movie never drags. The dialogue is crisp. It's fun. It's quotable. The characters are really interesting. And all of the performers give everything they have. I have to give this 8 out of 10 cop uniforms under a judge's robe.
I think this is very deeply charming. It's very entertaining. You and I have, Marco, have butted heads before on the idea of art not changing minds, and I don't agree with you at all.
I know.
I think there's plenty has been said and written about the opposite opinion on that situation, but I don't want to get into that all over again. Just listen to our Coastal Elites review. This is, it's fun. If it falls, the only way that it falls for me is that I think Eddie Redmayne is kind of terrible in this. Oh. He's playing one of the primary characters in here, Tom Hayden, who is on the left side, the one who's regularly sort of butting heads with Abbie Hoffman. And it's not till the very end that it felt like he was there for it at all. I found myself going, shut up, Eddie Redmayne. I want to hear what Sacha Baron Cohen is trying to say, which isn't a problem usually because he's pretty loud. But other than that, I thought this was great. Frank Langella rules as the evil judge. It's going a bit far to say he's chewing up all the scenery, but he's so good. And he just knows exactly how far to push it and make it seem plausible, which is hard to do because you can't believe there was ever, or still are, judges that are that terrible. Mark Rylance is, as near as I can tell, having watched Kunstler in videos, it's a pretty dead-on impression of Kunstler, who was a fascinating guy. I'm surprised there hasn't been a biopic about him, because he, like, was on some of the big, important trials and has had his ups and downs. A fascinating figure. I would have liked to have seen more about him here. Hell, I really found myself wishing, why wasn't this a miniseries? Well, because Oscars go further than Emmys do, I'm afraid. And that's what they were hoping for. And it really is a shame, because this easily could have been stretched out to like at least 4 episodes and you still would have gone, wow, that just flew by.
Yeah.
I wanted to see Arlo Guthrie take the stand. Like, what really happened? I kind of love this overall outside of the Eddie Redmayne issue, and I'm going to give it 9 out of 10 Draculas put into court positions. They need to stop electing all these Draculas onto the court. What do they think was going to happen?
Look, man, in the late 70s, early 80s, Frank Langella was a very sexy man. And that's why he played Dracula.
With beautiful curls.
And eventually you become old and you become a cranky old judge. It's what happens to character actors.
You start off as like a Frank Langella and then you turn into a Nosferatu.
Yeah. Pretty much.
Peter Cushing for Supreme Court.
It's a little late for that.
Or is it?
Or is it, exactly.
Retire now in our moment of triumph? I think you underestimate their chances.
They have uploaded me completely to CGI now, and I am more powerful than you can possibly imagine.